Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The legislative session races to the finish line and much is left to be done. Dana Ferguson is in a committee meeting at Peer. She'll join us later in the segment. But we've got Roger Whittle, who's managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion, on the line from Watertown. Roger, welcome back.
Thanks, Lori. It's nice to be here.
It's nice to talk to you because I'm going to put you on the spot and have you explain to me what a shell bill is. Is that something that you can do?
I think I can wing it.
All right, shell bills and hog housing. I need to get this in.
You know, that was a new one on me.
Okay.
A shell bill, there's a cutoff date of when lawmakers can introduce legislation. And what they will do sometimes is introduce what's called a shell bill, just be a blank bill. They will introduce it so it's on the schedule, and then they can fill it in with whatever they want to it at a later date.
Okay.
Apparently it's a common practice in state legislatures, but apparently some people are upset about it.
Some people are upset, but it's totally legal and common. And the idea is that sometimes you just run out of time. Or is the idea that you're sneaking things under the table?
Oh, I'm sure our lawmakers wouldn't actually sneak anything under the table.
No.
It's mostly a time thing, and the things may change during the course of the session, and something might come up that you actually want a bill on, that actually originates after the cutoff date for new bills. So. They've been doing it for a long time. Our attorney general said it's perfectly legal, but he also said that if the legislature wanted to, they could create a rule against that and make it illegal. So we'll see how
so
that
it's up
plays
to them.
Out.
So Lee Sturbinger, our political reporter, was explaining hog housing to me earlier in our first hour, and that's just sort of drastically amending something, as I understand it. Do I have that understanding correct?
You know, I saw that word in a story, and I had never heard of it before. But I will.
I'm not alone. All right.
I will understanding trust your is reporter with my life. So.
Right, and I've got Dana Ferguson's article right in front of me too, and she says it's a bill that has a substantially different title. And Lee said, you know, drastically amended. So somewhere in there is the full picture.
Yeah,
and I
would say there's really not much difference than taking another bill and changing it to what you want, or
sure,
taking a blank bill and making it what you want.
So all this,
you know, fine line.
Yeah, all this, Roger, goes back to this notion of ethics and transparency and, campaign finance reform and all these things that have sort of been top of mind in this legislative session as people start asking questions. Well, you know, maybe we always ask questions about these things, but they're certainly top of mind right now, would you say?
It really is. I think when the legislature decided to, the first thing they did was eliminate the bill that the voters passed.
Right.
I think they were kind of setting themselves up, you know, for a little bit of pushback. I think there were better ways they could have handled the situation so as not to upset people. But, you know, now that they did, and now they're dealing with the repercussions.
Let's talk about some articles in the Watertown Public Opinion written by Bob Mercer this week. And, again, dealing with EB-5 and, you know, where money is coming into the state. Let's start with these advertisements sort of challenging Representative Kristi Noem on federal taxes and where that money is coming from. What do you know there?
Well, that seems to be a theme these days. People want to know where this dark money is coming from and who's responsible. It seems to be a big issue every time we have a lot of ballot measures that are being funded from out-of-state entities. So,
and some of them got through this year, Marcy's Law, you know, constitutional amendment S, as I recall, and then
and the ethics one,
yeah, initiated measure 22. So, what's happening with Kristi Noem? This is something that what are the ads? Do you know? She hasn't taken a position on. It's the border adjustment tax. There, I found it. So it's something about the Congressional Border Adjustment Tax and sort of attacking her position on it.
Well, I think she, I'm not real familiar with the issue, but my guess would be that she's opening herself up to attacks because she has she wants to run for governor, and people are using anything they can now to draw questions about her.
Sure. So what do you think is ahead for money coming from out of state, Roger? Do you think that's something we can really limit and tie that into First Amendment rights?
Well, they tried it before, even on a national level, to limit the amount of money you can spend, and it all comes back to the Constitution. I mean, the way the law is written now, that the courts have said that if you restrict somebody's the amount of money somebody can spend on a campaign, you are restricting their free speech. And that's a good point. I don't know how you get around it. That's I guess for the courts and the legislatures to decide at this point.
All right. And state auditor looking at grants and making the connection between money coming in and money going out.
Yeah, this is a direct result of the EB-5 and the Gear Up incidences that the state went through recently. They're just looking for a little more oversight over the monies that are going through these quasi-public-private partnerships and making sure that these kind of things don't happen again that have happened in the past. I think that's a good idea, a good plan. We'll have to wait and see exactly what comes out of the other side of the bills. But people are obviously upset about the things that have gone in the past, and I see this as a good thing that the lawmakers are actually trying to tackle this problem.
All right. Roger, we're going to pull Dana Ferguson in. We've got her on the phone from Pierre. Dana, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you, Lori. How are you?
Doing well. We'll catch you up on what Roger and I have been talking as you come out of your committee meeting. We've talked about the state auditor looking at grants sort of in response to some of the scandals we've had passed in the state, checking money in and out. And we've talked about out-of-state money and some advertising attacks on U.S. Representative Kristi Noem. And then earlier we talked about shell bills and the illustrious Hog House, and we're hoping that you can help us. Our producer, Chris Loffrey, gives me the definition of Hog House. Roger, are you ready?
I am.
It's a procedure occasionally used in the legislature whereby a committee or member from the floor will move to strike everything after the enacting clause of a bill and insert, in lieu thereof, the substance of an entirely new bill. Thank you, Chris Loffrey. And that's the official definition. Dana, how does a hog house work in South Dakota politics?
You know, it's been interesting to watch this year. Historically, there will be a certain number of shell bills or vehicle bills that have an enacting clause that's pretty vague. So they can be to benefit education in South Dakota or to, you know, do something that sounds super great. And then the body of the bill itself that when it gets introduced is also very vague. It'll be maybe one sentence that says, here's what we want to do. Again, sounds very simple, not really anything that would have a huge impact on legislation in the state. But as you mentioned, once it is hog-housed, it is completely amended, often in committee, to totally change what it is going to do. We have seen a couple of those this year. I would say maybe 10, but that's just a rough estimate at this point. So one that I'm thinking about specifically, Senate Bill 176, went into Senate State Affairs Committee as a bill aimed at protecting the public in South Dakota, and came out after having been hog-housed by representatives in the governor's office as a pretty extensive measure that would give additional authority to the governor in situations of extreme protest and set up additional sets of penalties for individuals who might be involved in those protests.
So, Dana, give me an idea of how folks can follow it then and know that it's happening, you know, citizens, journalists, etc.
Yeah, certainly. If you go on to the South Dakota Legislature's website, they have a tag, maybe not the easiest thing to find, but they do have a specific page that looks just at those bills that have been hog-housed. You can see what they were and what they've become and where they are in the process. I would say that the majority of the shell bills that started this session have been tabled at this point. There are just a couple that were hog-housed, but the bulk of them at this point have been tabled, so they're not something that the legislators are going to be working on or smoking out or doing anything like that at this point. And just to clarify, smoking out means if something fails in committee, legislators have the ability to bring that up on the House or Senate floor, and they can reconsider and debate on a bill at that time, even if it doesn't make it through committee.
How do they smoke it out? A certain number of people have to be involved in that?
Yeah, there needs to be a certain amount of support, and I can't recall offhand exactly how much.
Sure.
But you need a certain number of legislators to say, sure, we don't think that bill necessarily got the best committee hearing. It deserves to be talked about with everyone in this body. And then, again, they have the ability to act on that on either floor.
And now when I first got here, Dana, SDPB reporter Keely Beltina said, sometimes things pass out of committee just to sort of avoid the smoke out, or because committee members might not be necessarily going to vote for it, but they think it's something that everyone should hear as well. So I thought that was an interesting edition. So State House 101 for all our listeners today. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment. We've got our Dakota Political Junkies for the day. Today it's Roger Whittle. He's managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion. He's joining us from Watertown. And Dana Ferguson is a watchdog government reporter for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, and she's joining us from Pierre. And so, Dana, let's talk about some of the big issues of the day. And I want to start with the Religious Protection Bill that affects adoption. Can you give us an overview of that?
Sure. So Senate Bill 149 was passed out of the Senate House State Affairs Committee this morning. And what it would do is provide additional protections to religious or faith-based child placement agencies. So that means that adoption agencies, foster care groups, would be able to maintain some of the policies they have that deal with who would be a good parent. So if you are a Christian faith agency and you think that parents of the kids that you're working with should be married, they should be also of whatever faith that you believe in, you know, under this bill, they would be protected and they would have the ability to do that without the fear of losing out on state contracts or any sort of state funding, which none of those that have policies like that are currently state funded for their adoption programs.
Sure.
But they say they want to make sure they won't have a threat of losing their licensures. They don't want to lose funding for mental health programs or other things that they work on. So they're trying to take a proactive move here and pass this legislation.
And who's sort of speaking out against that?
Yeah, we've seen advocates for the LGBT community, civil liberties groups, representatives for a National Social Workers Organization, as well as a few others saying that this doesn't seem like the right way to go. There's not really been a threat of cutting off that any sort of separate funding for those agencies or asking them to get rid of whatever policies they might have in determining who is a qualified parent. So opponents are saying that the legislation seems discriminatory in that some of those organizations that do private adoptions could become state contract holders. And under this legislation, they would still be able to get state funding and maintain their policies that could bar same-sex couples, single parents, or others from adopting or fostering children.
Dana, do we know how Governor Dugard falls on this issue, if it makes its way to his desk? Do we have an idea if he'll veto it or if he'll let it go forward?
He hasn't weighed in on this one yet. His chief of staff, Tony Van Huysen, said that he hasn't heard from the governor yet on what his views are. He will likely take the process he does with most of these bills, read through them, listen back to all the testimony, do some sort of analysis of how similar policies have worked elsewhere before coming to a conclusion. But at this point, it's unclear exactly what he's going to do.
Roger, any thoughts from Watertown on adoption and how that might affect different communities in your neck of the woods?
Not that I've heard, and as Dana said, this as it sits now, there are no groups that are having this problem. You know, the bill doesn't affect anybody now. It's just they want safeguards for the future. And I think one of the things that people against this bill are saying is that all you're really doing is by for one thing denying same-sex couples the right to adopt, you're actually shrinking the pool of available parents for adoption, which actually ultimately hurts the kids in the state who in foster care who need adoption.
Mm. Dana, what have we learned about those numbers and kids who are being adopted in the state through this process? Have we learned things that maybe we didn't know before?
You know, I have a records request out to the Department of Social Services aiming to get a breakdown of exactly how many South Dakota kiddos this might affect. At this point, we know how many are in foster care and how many are ready to be adopted, and that number is about 300. So as you mentioned, opponents are saying that by taking prospective parents out of that pool, you're keeping some of those kids in foster care longer or eliminating some of the options for them. And opponents, too, have said that it can be beneficial for kids who identify as LGBT to have parents, foster parents or adoptive parents who also are LGBT and can really understand where they're coming from and help them process situations that they're going through.
It seems like it might also affect the Native American community if a Christian-based organization, you know, was looking at a Native American family that had, you know, traditional spiritual values instead of a Christian faith. Dana, are we hearing anything from that or the Muslim community or anyone else?
There's been some concern about how it would impact those communities. At this point, the language is too vague to really understand exactly what the impact would be. And I think that's been a substantial problem for both sides in trying to concretely say what's going to happen if it passes. Other states that have this legislation have clear descriptions of what it means to be a faith-based organization or to have a sincerely held religious belief. The South Dakota legislation doesn't have that right now. So there was pretty serious concern this morning from the committee about whether that could create problems. But supporters of the measure said that was because they didn't want to box any organization into setting sort of their mission statement or explaining what their sincerely held religious beliefs are.
Sure. Dana, let's move on to the resettlement of refugees and some resolutions sort of condemning how that is done in the state. You want to start us off?
Sure. So this morning, the Senate State Affairs Committee took up Senate Concurrent Resolution 15, which essentially is entering a vote of no confidence in the vetting processes for refugees and especially for organizations that work with them in South Dakota. As we know, there's just one organization, Lutheran Social Services, that resettles refugees in the state. So during the nearly or more than 2-hour public hearing today, there was extensive testimony on both sides. Individuals from Huron, Rapid City, and Aberdeen speaking to some of the problems they've seen with refugee placements in those cities and sort of expressing their concerns about the way that refugees are vetted and what potential security issues could result from not having substantial procedures to ensure that those entering the country are safe and they don't mean Americans any harm.
Is it mainly a concern for security, or is there a values-based conversation as well?
It's a little bit of both. And we heard both sides this morning. Senator Neil Tapio, who is the resolution's author, said that he doesn't believe that some of the practices that are more extreme, such as female genital mutilation or honor killings, are in line with American values. And so he had deep concerns with allowing some individuals from areas or from religions that practice those sorts of things to come to the U.S. And he said he wasn't completely satisfied with the way that the United States' current vetting processes are able to determine whether someone believes in the religions that practice those or has been involved in those sort of practices before. Mm-hmm. Opponents were quick to say that many of the refugees coming to the U.S. are escaping those practices and might have been the victims of those, and that essentially saying that some cultures or religions or something like that are better than others is not the way to be handling policy when it comes to who's going to be entering the U.S.
Hmm. Roger, Senator Neil Tapio, right from Watertown. What are
yes,
you hearing in your community?
Well, first of all, this is just a resolution that really has no authority to it. It's, I think I read a quote from Senator Tapio today that said he just wants to pass this resolution to let the president know that South Dakota is on board with his view of immigration reform. Hmm. Which made me think, I'm sure the president is very concerned about
paying attention to Neil Tapio.
Before,
yeah.
before he moves forward with, he wants to make sure South Dakota is on board. So,
well, no, he was he was president, or he was Donald Trump's campaign director, right? So,
Regional state
okay.
campaign director.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. What else do we know about Neil Tapio and the issue in general? Is it an issue that needs to be addressed?
Well, he thinks it is. So, you know, when you're in the position where you can introduce resolutions, that's really all that matters.
That's what you do.
I haven't heard that genital mutilation has been much of a problem in South Dakota. Maybe I'm not reading the right newspapers or something. but you know, like I say, it's a resolution, and I'm sure that he'll get enough. Enough people just to sign it and pass it, it's harmless. It has no power. So,
is it harmless if it makes a statement that some people find discriminatory?
Well, yeah, of course you're right. In that case, yeah, harmless was a poor choice of words. But I mean, as far as altering or affecting our state or our policy, it won't do anything. But I would agree that some parts of it may. Contribute to some discriminatory actions, but
Dana, when do we find out the sort of fate of SCR 15?
That will be coming up later on this afternoon. The committee hearing actually went too long this morning. They started at 10 and got done at about 12:15, but the committee wasn't able to take up any discussion because they had so much testimony.
Wow.
So they'll be reconvening whenever the Senate adjourns this afternoon, I would guess around 3, and again, taking up that conversation before voting on that resolution as well as on a couple of gun bills.
All right. The issues of our times. Dana Ferguson is with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. We reached her in Pier, Roger Whittle, Watertown, Public Opinion. Dana, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Busy day this afternoon for you, so good luck. And Roger, thanks as well for your time.
Thank you.
Welcome back to In the Moment. Judges, attorneys, and law enforcement officers endorse a bill in South Dakota's State House that aims to ease mental health problems for people entering the justice system. SDPB's Keely Bultina joins us live from the University of Sioux Falls to talk about different facets of the bill. Hey, Keely.
Hi, Lori.
So it's a task force on mental health, and they researched what happens and what should happen for coping with folks dealing with mental health issues as they intersect with the state's criminal justice system. And now we have House Bill 1183, right?
Right. The broad purpose is this concept of improving mental health care. And obviously, because it comes through the unified judicial system, we're looking at improving mental health care where people who need that help are intersecting with the justice system. So more specifically, there are two main veins to this, you know, giant bill. There's the idea that we need to get people services, and there's the idea that we need to train people who are in the justice system to provide the care at the right levels, at the right time, for the right people.
Hmm. And how does this measure do that? Let's start with how supporters say the bill helps people get the help they need faster and better.
Well, right now, South Dakota has no limit on how long someone can wait in custody for a mental health assessment. So one element of House Bill 1183 is a new rule that limits that to 21 days. Greg Satizon is the state court administrator, and he says people who need mental health care need more attention.
Once they're in the criminal justice system, they're much more likely to stay longer than people that do not suffer from mental illness. There's significant delays in competency evaluations, and this all leads to greater costs for the counties.
And Greg Satizon says it's about $90 per day per person to keep someone in jail. So the fact that they are adjusting this to be a 21-day maximum unless there's good cause, in theory, saves a lot of money if people are waiting months for these sort of evaluations.
But just saying you want to keep the waiting period to 21 days doesn't help if you don't have the trained professionals to perform those assessments.
Exactly. And people with the unified judicial system say the pieces of this bill all fit together and support each other. They say that's the reason that the bill expands the kinds of mental health professionals who can administer mental health assessments. So Section 18 in the bill adds in people like certified nurse practitioners or counselors or social workers who have the right training and practical experience to administer these evaluations. That's because right now counties are often waiting to send people to state facilities, and the maximum for that, they basically tripled what they can handle over the last couple of years. So instead of waiting to send people someplace to have the evaluation, the unified judicial system wants local law enforcement to connect with local facilities and local providers to make sure that that happens in a timely manner and gets people the help that they need.
All right. So that to me seems that it's addressing folks who are arrested and then and who need mental health care at the time that they sort of meet that law enforcement officer. Does this bill address anything to help people before they would go to jail?
Yes, there are two main elements here, too. There's a jail mental health screening pilot program that is put together in the bill. It brings together at least four jail administrators and two mental health providers to pick a tool for the pilot program, and then they'll implement that in at least four jails and see how it goes. So there's that aspect of it. Then there's this concept of expanding crisis management training opportunities for law enforcement. Section 7 of the Mental Health Criminal Justice Bill creates this grant through the Department of, and it'll be administered through the Department of Social Services. So cities, counties, or groups of counties can develop new crisis response services or expand the programs that they have.
So Keely, before we go any further, who pays for it?
Always a good question, right? Leaders in the court say that the unified judicial system is finding the funding in their own budget. So it's no cost to the state's general fund, which is the main budget lawmakers construct and balance every year.
All right. So let's return to the notion of developing and expanding programs. Expansion means some places in South Dakota already have teams to respond to mental health crises.
Yes. So there are some officers who are trained specifically to deal with people experiencing mental health crises. And there are about 20 departments statewide that have officers that are trained in this crisis management. When it comes to connecting with the community, different parts of the state have different approaches when law enforcement collaborate with mental health professionals. In Pennington County, Rapid City, there's a crisis care center to help people who need it. Hughes County has a mobile crisis team, and Minnehaha County does too. Minnehaha County had the first. The Sioux Falls mission is to get mental health professionals to the people when they're experiencing an episode, so that right there they can coordinate resources, assess the problem, and eliminate unnecessary psychiatric placements and jail time. Sioux Falls Police Sergeant David Osterquist says he remembers responding to a call several years ago. An older woman was drinking and threatening to hurt herself. Osterquist is specifically trained to work with people struggling in mental emergencies. He says he spent time with the woman, kept her calm, and made her comfortable.
I reached out to a friend of hers to come spend time with her so she wasn't alone. And several months later, we received a letter in the mail from her saying, "I know I treated all of you badly, but the help you provided me that night led me to get treatment, and now I am leading a productive life."
Osterquist says that's the goal of the Mobile Crisis Team. It's a group of mental health professionals on call 24 hours a day. They meet people in their moments of need instead of handcuffing and hospitalizing them.
With 70 to 75% of the people not needing follow-up work, it was clear that something different needed to be done because we were wasting resources putting people on mental illness holds, locking them up in a locked facility when it wasn't really what they needed to be successful.
Osterquist says a task force laid the foundation for the work, but no one knew exactly how to develop it. So he says he and Southeastern Behavioral Health's Chris Graham just started one. He says they scoured versions of mobile crisis work from around the country and plucked the pieces that best fit Minnehaha and Lincoln counties. Graham says they launched the joint mental health effort in 2010.
One of the reasons that Southeastern got involved, too, is because we do crisis calls as part of our community mental health work. And so it helped us to learn more techniques about de-escalation and how to work with people in a crisis situation. So it was really a good fit for us that way.
Graham says the operation in Sioux Falls emphasizes the mobile in mobile crisis team. Sioux Falls Police Sergeant Tara Walton explains how it works. She says it may start because a person is threatening self-harm and a friend or family member is worried.
Obviously, the person's scared. Who do we call when we're scared or we're afraid? 911. We're raised to do that from the very beginning.
Once those numbers ring through, Walton says police evaluate the call.
The officers would be asked to respond. They'd make contact with the person, make sure the environment's safe, and then assess the situation at that point. Does this fit the need for the mobile crisis team?
Specific parameters exist to answer that question. Walton says officers cannot call the mobile crisis team if a person has taken action to harm himself or herself. The person can't be too inebriated with drugs or alcohol to function and work with officers, and he or she cannot be violent. In those cases, law enforcement prioritize safety. Megan Wexler is a therapist who coordinates the mobile crisis team.
Say we get called and they're not taking their meds. Every person does have the right to refuse their own medication. So as we can go, we can definitely strongly encourage them. We'll assess like their symptoms that are going on. Sometimes there's medical meds that is life or death if they don't take it. If they're refusing, okay, we're going to intervene by making you go to the hospital.
Wexler says even people who do need mental health treatment don't automatically require a placement from law enforcement.
We'll encourage them to go to the hospital voluntarily rather than putting them on the hold, because that still gives them more of a right than putting them on the hold. Pretty much takes away all their rights.
Sioux Falls Police Sergeant David Osterquist says law enforcement and the mobile crisis team operate in serious situations.
That officer has to have, by statute, probable cause to place that person on a mental illness hold before the mobile crisis team can be activated. Once the officer determines that probable cause exists, they can then contact a mental health professional and have them respond to the scene and deal with it. They're statutorily protected. The handoff is spelled out in state law about how that is supposed to work. The mental health professional then makes a determination whether or not they want the officer to stick around or whether they want to release the officer to go back to work. And then that mental health worker, that mobile crisis team member, deals with the situation and then makes recommendations and determinations for that person.
The purpose is to respond and develop a safety plan. If that person can stay in the home, that means no unnecessary medical bills from a hospital. It means the person doesn't miss work the next day, and any children involved don't have to go into government placement. In January alone, Minnehaha County's mobile crisis team handled a record 47 calls, and not one of those required hospitalization. Southeastern Behavioral Health CEO Chris Graham says leaders are constantly asking questions to ensure the program's efficacy.
Are there repeat users of mobile crisis, or were they one-time situations?
Graham says 3 out of 4 people who need mental health help in the community don't call again in the same year. Police officers, though, do encounter people repeatedly outside of crises. Sioux Falls Police Sergeant Tara Walton says the mobile crisis team fosters relationships.
Someone that we took the time to help and not just take to a mental health facility or take to jail, but we showed empathy and we showed some understanding and wanted to get them help rather than just find a quick solution. Those people are more responsive to us in future contacts. There's some mutual respect that takes place and some understanding. And I've definitely seen an appreciation in the community from those people that we've been able to touch or those family members as well.
The mobile crisis team that covers Minnehaha and can go into Lincoln County responds to about 400 calls on average per year. With a record January, that number could change for this year.
Keely, you've been covering this and looking pretty deeply into it for some time. What has surprised you that you've learned?
When it came to the mobile crisis team, I thought about officers and mental health workers responding to homes. This makes sense. That's what they right. do. Houses, apartments, right? But they also respond to places like city parks or other public spaces where someone might be struggling and need help. I just never thought of it in that way.
Right.
That, of course, people need help in different places during their lives. I also have to mention, I was struck by how highly they value privacy and that community connection. There were stories they wouldn't tell me and said things like, oh, there's this great story I would love to tell you. This would be so good to tell you because it made such a difference. But the details are too specific, and I don't want to risk that person or their family members hearing that we're talking about them because that's not what we do. Hmm. We work with the people in the community, and we develop their trust, and we're there for them. Not for you.
And that's incredibly important all across South Dakota, and then has an interesting twist in a smaller town as well as a bigger city like Sioux Falls.
Absolutely, yes.
Right, yeah. So with the grant program looking to expand and create these teams, earlier today we talked about issues of accountability. What does accountability look like in this context?
House Bill 1183 has data required for the number of applications to the grant program, the amounts of money awarded, the location, the purpose, the population served, and they're supposed to be reported twice a year. And then the legislation also creates an oversight council. So staff are from the UJS through the courts, and courts now have to provide things like the number of people referred to mental health court, numbers of people admitted, the percentage of people who complete the court's requirements, and then the number of people convicted of a new crime in 1 to 3 years after completing that mental health court's rubric. So it's trying to watch for those numbers and understand what those trends look like and really figure out, is a system like this going to be effective?
How House Bill 1183 is 17 pages long. I want to make sure to touch on the additional training for law enforcement officers. The bill includes mental health training for judges, attorneys, and law enforcement.
Yes, and I don't want to get too wonky here, but in the legislative session, we often hear arguments over words like may and shall. So this bill uses the word shall, so that's prescriptive in state law. May allows organizations to do things, but shall compels them. So in this bill, they're going to train people from jail staff to judges because that's what the bill says. South Dakota Supreme Court Justice Chief David Gilbertson testified on this point in committee when he spoke to them on Monday.
Tomorrow will be my 32nd anniversary of being a judge. I don't think I've ever had mental health training. And we would propose it for judges, for prosecutors, defense attorneys, law enforcement people, really important group, intake officers in jails. We usually have that initial contact. And probation officers also.
And we've heard from the Chief Justice many times before as the court system and other leaders are looking at things like mental illness and also things like juvenile justice reform. And so they're trying to find ways to address problems that they see in the court system and in the jails and in the prisons before it has to get to that point. So it's all about that early intervention. I should also mention that this bill contains an emergency clause. That just means the bill, if it's passed by the full state Senate and then signed by Governor Dennis Dugard, can take effect immediately.
All right. SDPP's Keely Boltina on mental health in the criminal justice system. Really great work, Keely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Bria Shea Neff is an artist and an illustrator. She was recently surprised with a celebration from the folks at Google. Bria is South Dakota's winner of the Doodle for Google contest. She joins us now in our studios at the University of South Dakota. The studio right now, you can't see it, but it's filled with beautiful, colorful artwork that I've been enjoying throughout the show. Bria, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, tell me how old you are.
I'm 10 years old.
All right, 10 years old, and you have been painting since you were even younger, I bet.
Yes.
All right. When did you start painting, and what were some of the first things that you were doing with paint?
I started making penguins and tigers at 6 years old.
All right. So start right away. I think at six I was still trying to taste the paint. And you were painting penguins and tigers. How come penguins and tigers?
At that time, I just loved those animals.
All right. What do you like about the tiger?
I love its stripes.
All that color, right?
Yeah.
And so tell me about your studio, because I looked you up on Facebook, and there's a video there of your artist studio at your house. It's amazing.
Thank you.
And you can really tell all the work that you do. There's paint on the table. There's paint on the floor. Tell me how you work to do these big canvases.
Well, it takes a couple days. And I think what I'm going to do, and then I search the animal and write about it, and then I paint it.
All right. So what have you learned in your research? Are you researching animals that you kind of knew something about?
Well, mostly endangered and critically endangered species.
All right. How did you learn about that? Why is that important to you?
Because all animals matter. Without animals, there'd be no us.
Without animals, there'd be no us. Interesting. So you have this project of endangered faces. You have a coloring book, right?
Yes, two of them.
So that other kids can sort of color in your designs. Tell me about the money that comes from selling your artwork and your coloring book. What happens to it?
Well, there's one coloring book at the zoo and at the Great Plains Zoo. And you can purchase it, and then the money will go to the zoo to help the animals there. And then my other coloring book will go to IFA, IFAW, and the International Fund for Animal Welfare, so it can help other animals.
And when people buy your paintings online, same thing. You donate donate the money. How come?
Because, like I said,
because you could keep it for college or something, right? You could go to Disney World.
Yeah, I know.
Tell me some of your favorite animals now.
I have many different favorite animals, but my two favorites would be wolves and cheetahs.
And then someone told me you also like the pangolin. Is that how I say that?
Yes.
What the heck is a pangolin?
It's like an armadillo, but with scales.
Okay, so on Valentine's Day, Google had a game. Did you see it?
Yes,
there was
I
this
did.
Little game. I got totally addicted to it, and it was with pangolins. And I said, what is a pangolin? And then I saw that you liked them too. So what are some of the surprises that you have found with different animals? The pangolin surprised me. Have other animals surprised you?
Well, it's a sea cow. And not really anything else.
How much time do you spend every day painting?
Probably 2 hours.
Really? Do you have music on at the same time? Or you like
yes.
it quiet? All right, what's your favorite music?
I would say,
what's rocking on your iPhone right now? You like fast or slow? Classical or jazzy?
Classical.
Oh, you like some classical music. All right. If you're just joining us, my guest on In the Moment is Bria Shaneff. She's an artist and illustrator. She's 10 years old, and she recently won the Doodle for Google contest for South Dakota. Tell me about that contest. You had to draw what?
I had to draw what I saw in the future, and what I saw in the future is all animals were wild and free and not endangered anymore.
All right. And you had to do the Google logo with all those animals, right? Those are some funky
yes.
letters to have to play with, some G's and some O's. How did you choose which animals would fit graphically into those spaces?
Well, I just visualized it and drew it.
Who do you admire as artists?
Chuck Black and Bob Ross.
Right. Bob Ross is awesome. He's on public broadcasting. Right? And then tell me about the surprise at the Washington Pavilion. And the folks from Google came out and they said they had a winner for the state. Did you know it was going to be you?
Not really that much.
You were totally shocked.
Yes.
So you're sitting in the audience and they have a big rainbow of balloons and they have a big poster up there and it's got your drawing on it, but you don't know it because there's a big sheet covering it up and it drops and then it's you. And then you had to go to on stage in front of everyone.
Yeah, it was very surprising.
And what happens now? People are still voting for you online?
Yes.
Okay, so you go on the website and you click and you vote and all over the country from every state there's a winner and you're representing South Dakota. People can vote every day, as I understand it, for the South Dakota Doodle winner. And we love our South Dakota artists, so I'm sure people are going to do that. What happens if you win in the nation, do you know?
You get to go to California and you get a $30,000 scholarship to college. You get a Chromebook, and if you're the top one, you get $45,000 to your school or any other place you would like it to go.
It is a big deal. And you can vote for South Dakota's Doodle for Google winner, Bria Shaneff. You go online, doodles.google.com/D4G, as in Doodle for Google. We'll put a link up on our website at listen.sdpb.org so everyone can do that. Bria, I want to say thank you so much for coming in. We're going to put some pictures up of your artwork online. I love these. They're all shapes and sizes, reds and blues and oranges. I see giraffes and whales and everything. What do you want to do with art in your future? Do you want to keep doing it?
Yes.
What have you not painted that you want to paint?
I want to paint probably a guppy.
A guppy. All right, you go, girl. Bria Shaneff, thanks for stopping by, and we appreciate your time.